Hi, my name is Brad Klein for TurfNet Renovation Report. Our guest today is golf course architect and renovation fellow Dan Hickson out of the Pacific Northwest. I want to thank our sponsors from the Andersons, Golf Preservations, and Capillary Bunkers. Dan, welcome to TurfNet Renovation Report. How you doing out there?
I'm doing good. Thanks, Bradley.
So I was looking you up, and you know, this is like social media age, promotion, billboard world. You don't even have a website. What is going on? Are you trying to keep your work a secret?
Well, I did have Instagram for a couple of years. I still have it. But I sort of did that just for a project for my golf course down in Roseburg called Bar Run. And so I promoted that. And then I just kind of quit doing that.
So,
but
website. I met you with Bandon Crossing in Bandon, Oregon, and Sylvie's Valley Ranch in the middle of the high desert plain. Tell us about how you got to the point where you're designing golf courses and renovating them. How did you get started in the business, and how did you become whatever you are now?
Well, I was a golf pro my last career, and I'd wanted to be a golf course architect like many guys for many years. And in the late 90s, I resigned from my position as a head professional in town and started a business a few years later, or just 1 year later. And I started out just doing the very smallest little projects, mostly through golf professionals, because I was in that circuit, and my older brother and dad are golf pros. And so a lot of golf pros knew who I was and that I was getting in the business. And so I just did a few greens and tees and bunkers early, and pretty soon started doing some short game areas. And just one thing led to another. My big break was, well, there's several, but Bandon Crossings was probably the biggest, to get a full golf course in, you know, fairly early in my career. I'd only been in about 5 years. And soon after that, as I went from Bandon Crossings, went to Wine Valley, and then Crestview, a 9-hole course I did on the Oregon coast, and which led to Sylvie's. And that got me through many years of the downturn in the economy. But Sylvie's took us like 7 years to build. So my business kept growing during that while I was building Sylvie's. And so it's been quite a run.
You're kind of a throwback, aren't you? You don't have big AutoCAD, a whole big staff. You're sort of a one, am I right? You're a one man band, basically.
Yeah, just one man. And the iPad has sure helped. I do tons of work on an iPad now, just with Google Earth, and do plan drawings from that. And I do a lot of perspective drawings. But I'm kind of to the point where I may have to go one way or the other, get a little smaller, or hire somebody, because I do have a lot of work coming in all the time. But you know, I enjoy all aspects of it. And the parts I don't join only last for a little while, so I know they're going to, I'll finish that and get it out of the way. So,
do you think some of your success is because precisely you're not one of these big budget, big name guys? And so there's a lot of golf courses out there that are modest. You know, you just finished, maybe you could talk a little bit about the one you did at Bend Golf Club in the west central part of the state.
Yeah, I think so. Oregon's had all the great architects, the current guys, and from Doak and Corin Crenshaw and Kidd. David Kidd lives in Oregon as well. And so, you know, most of the clubs just kind of don't go that path. Gil Hance did Waverly, and not far from where I live, even here in Portland area. And so I think you're right a little bit. I definitely haven't done the high profile projects like a lot of those guys have, but I work at 8 of the 11 clubs in Portland, and we just finished a bunker renovation at Bend just a few months ago. And it was a Chandler Egan golf course, and I'd been working there for 6 or 7 years with a long range plan that we'd been kind of clicking a few things off, and that was great. Scott Moffenbeyer's a superintendent there, so actually his brother is on the greens committee for Oswego Lake, my next project, starting just next week, big project. And so Scott's a great superintendent, and he was really good to work with at Bend, and we really improved that place on a fairly modest project by kind of national standards.
Yeah, you. I think the number was 37 bunkers you built for, and average was about 860 square feet. So, and you did that for total cost, as I understand, the whole project, including your massive fee, was about $550,000, including everything, right?
That's it. Yeah, that's... including sand into the bunkers and sod and contractor and everything.
So how do you keep costs down and still make sure you get quality?
Well, I think it's a lot, mostly the contractors, but, you know, we really think it through, and not saying that other guys don't, but, you know, that golf course, I think when I first started there, gosh, I already forgot the number. I just looked it up, but it was, I think 47 bunkers or in the 50s, actually. So we filled in quite a few bunkers, and really just tried to make them all mean something. And, you know, the contractors just gave us a good price, and we worked real hard and fast to, you know, make sure that we got it right and on time and on budget. So really just watching every individual deal. And so.
How detailed a set of plans do you draw? And then how much time do you spend on site? And what is it you're doing when you are on site?
Well, like Bend, my projects all vary quite a bit. Bend, I went once a week. It's about a little over 3 hours, about 3.5 hours away. And so I would usually come in and see it in the afternoon and then spend the whole next day there with the crew and stuff. And so we're looking at forward projects, future bunkers, painting them out, flagging them out, whatever we have to do, having discussions of what they look like. I oftentimes always in advance to the bunker, I would have a player perspective view that I draw on an iPad, where I take a picture of that bunker or that part of the green where the bunker is going to go, and I draw it pretty detailed, and then I can just send that directly to the shaper, contractor, shaper, superintendent gets it, and he can literally look on his phone and be shaping to my design off of a picture on his phone from a human perspective as opposed to a plan view. I do detailed drawings. I'm doing, as we speak, just a few miles from my house, we're completely rebuilding Lake Oswego Muni golf course, which is 18 hole par three, turning it into a nine holer. And so I had to do very detailed drawings for that. And I had a landscape architect that would do the AutoCAD part of it for me. And so I vary anything from, you know, just get on a dozer and start building with just a little sketch, to any, you know, anywhere to full plans and stuff. But yeah, you're right. I don't do AutoCAD myself, and most projects don't need it. And so
if they do need it, is it for the purpose of construction, or is it to facilitate a bid process?
Usually more for a bid process and or just approval, like through the city needed to see it. And, you know, they demanded, you know, that we have complete plans and stuff. And I've only done one golf course with a housing component, and that was for for Wine Valley. And so they needed to, you know, to be able to tie the lot pads basically to the golf course and have it all on AutoCAD. Those houses never were built. So that's, which is, I think, a good thing in that sense. But so when I'm there, I usually am, you know, I'm in the dirt, and a lot of my projects, when we rebuild greens, I will often jump on a dozer and do kind of the beginning, kind of the setup or creative shaping, and then usually let somebody that's a better operator than me clean it up and make it work, you know, and cut the green core perfectly and make sure my grades, you know, I'll be with them, but make sure my grades are right and stuff. And then on full projects, you know, on full golf courses, I do most of the shaping, you know, certainly around the greens. And like I said, all the kind of setup and design or creative side of it. And so.
You've been working, is it fair to say, primarily in the Pacific Northwest or exclusively out there? I mean,
Pretty much exclusively. I've worked on a project in California, but I did it on a day rate. I didn't put a name to it or anything. It was just a bunker, basically a bunker renovation, but my work was just three short trips to it. And because it was mostly fill in a golf course, it had, I don't know, 5 acres of bunkers, and we were cutting it way back, 36 hole project. Mm-hmm. But so yeah, just Oregon, Washington primarily. I did a little bit in Montana, and I've looked at a project in Idaho, and but really just Oregon and Washington, and right up and down the I-5 corridors, other than a few out east. So,
and what sort of trends are you? You've been now in the business for what, almost 20 years? Is that right?
Yeah, a little over. I started the business in 2000. So, the trends are, you know, people are, you know, doing big projects, very big projects. Like Portland Golf Club that I worked on last year was, they're putting in a full irrigation system this year. We did a complete remodel, 52 bunkers, one new last approach and everything to a par five, the last 75 yards of the hole, lots of tee work, tree work, mowing, but major adjustments to that's a 1918 or 1920, had the Ryder Cup and the PGA Championship there at 46 and 47, I think. Mm-hmm. And, real famous course for our area. And, you know, I never did massive remodels like that. And there's a lot of people talking about them. I have like three or four kind of on the docket now.
And I should know this. What's the design history of Portland Golf Club? Is that H. Chandler Egan as well?
No, I can't even think of the guy's name. Joe, he only worked on that course. I believe he was a Scotsman that was a professional and laid it out, and it got switched around, you know, in the first 10 or 15 years of the course. I could get my book out and look at it, but I can't think of what it is right now.
Well, we'll get it by the second half. Yeah, we'll get it by the second half. What do you bring to the table as a player? Most of the, I don't know what your, how detailed a history you have with competitive golf. Did you play competitively on tours somewhere?
I did. Right out of college, I went to Australia and I qualified and played that tour in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. Not very successful. And then I got into the club business because my family was in that. And I got into that business for a while. Then I went back out and played the mini tours for a couple mm-hmm. years. I tried to qualify for the PGA Tour. I made it through stage one. And then in stage two in Sacramento, I was in a playoff. There was seven of us for two or three spots. And I finished one out of the spot. And mm-hmm. so I didn't make it to finals. And that's when I took my job at Columbia Edgewater as an assistant, and eventually soon after the head pro job. And so I think I don't know if you have to be, you know, that question comes up once in a while. Do you have to be a good golfer to, and I don't really think so. You need to understand the game. And, you know, I think I've learned a lot, and I have kind of I studied golf course architecture on my own, but really, you know, teaching anywhere from really good players, lots of scratch players, right down to, you know, 40 handicap older gals, women, and, just kind of learn the game thoroughly and what people like, and just kind of always studied the golf course on my own. And so I sort of have a liberal study view of it, as opposed to a landscape architect or maybe somebody that came from the construction side, even though I love the construction side, but I learned that later on.
Yeah. I mean, what you must learn a lot by watching different skill sets and listening to stories or watching how people actually play a golf hole, as opposed to, you know, imaginary PGA Tour guy knocking down a 5 par with a 6 iron second shot. So it's
for sure, you know. Yeah. Touring courses, you know, just any of the courses, you know, I was on two different courses last week, up in Tacoma and in Bellevue, Seattle area. And, there's golfers out there all the time. And so you're constantly watching people and just see where they tee, where does their tee ball go? And, you know, when they miss the green, where does it end up? And and I've said this before too, that, I mean, I think being really good at what I do, is mostly observation. You know, yeah. Look at the golf course and realistically look at it. And the same goes for a really good superintendent, I think, is, you know, truthfully observe your golf course and look for flaws that need to get improved and just know it in detail and don't kind of glaze over and just look past it. And I think that's how a lot of design kind of goes bad, is it's like, well, we'll put a bunker over there. And that's the thought of it, as opposed to, you know, really kind of getting a little bit deeper into the thinking of how that bunker should go in there.
Yeah. And how much you in this time do you see a different orientation or a little more attention on the part of superintendents to design issues? Usually for a long time there was kind of a separation, and I think a number of architects took a slightly haughty view and really didn't want to get engaged in the day-to-day. You know, their view was essentially, well, you maintain it view, rather than building in concerns about maintainability. And how has that changed over the years, or your relationship with superintendents in that regard?
You know, each project varies a lot, and I try to really think a lot. And I have a lot of people at courses that I've worked at, and they says, gosh, we've never heard any of the guys that we've used in the past never said that they were worried about the shade from that tree because the greens maintenance. And so I work really hard at that, trying to get that relationship with the superintendent, that we're on the same page and that I'm not doing stuff that he's going to resent. And, you know, I welcome to be involved as much or as little on a day-to-day deal and participate in design ideas and stuff like that. And I like to be open to other people's design ideas, whether it's from somebody from a committee or the board or a superintendent, because it's maybe a better idea than mine. And so I think having no ego on that and allowing that is really important. And a lot of times the superintendents will bring great ideas about that, but I love to talk about how it's going to get mowed and, you know, where's the grassing lines going to be. And, you know, is this going to work for them? And it's funny, Bradley, because some superintendents are just right there all the time. And this is the highlight of their moment in their career to do a big project. And then other people have, you know, it just doesn't have their own personal interest, even though they really want it to be great. And they, you know, do everything they can do it. It's just the design is just not that important to them. And so I would say overall, though, that, you know, that the superintendents are kind of more and more, the sun's hit me in the face here, are more and more involved in that. And like I said, I think it's important. And that's really the one of the most fun thing here. I mean, there's merit to this in my sense is that a good crew, a happy crew, and a happy situation creates a better product. Right. No doubt it happens on full golf course projects. And so, you know, kind of getting everybody on the team and making everybody feel important and having them open to feel free to not make decisions, but offer suggestions and stuff, I think is really important. And I do think it, you know, somehow ends up in the work and, you know, in the final product.
We're going to take a quick break here. Our guest is golf course architect Dan Hixon. This is Brad Klein here for TurfNet Renovation Report. And I want to thank our sponsors, the Andersons, Golf Preservations, and Capillary Bunkers. We'll be right back.
From fairway and greens drainage to full-scale renovation work, Golf Preservations can handle your project with ease and give you the peace of mind of knowing the professionals are caring for your valuable golf course assets. Since 2005, Golf Preservations has meticulously installed over 500 miles of drainage pipe on more than 300 golf courses nationwide, always keeping disruption of play to a minimum. Visit golfpreservations.com or call 606-499-2732 to speak with us about your next drainage or renovation project.
Introducing Genesis RX, a line of comprehensive fertility and soil amendment solutions specifically designed for aerification, construction, renovation, sodding, sprigging, and seeding. These blends represent the most comprehensive fertilizers the Andersons have ever produced, offering single product solutions designed to simplify fertility and save time in application. To learn more, visit andersonsplantnutrient.com/turf.
The capillary bunker system keeps bunker moisture at optimal levels to eliminate washouts, soil contamination, plugged ball lies, and other bunker maintenance and playability problems. The patented capillary bunker system not only rapidly drains rain from storms, but also moves moisture back up to the bunker sand through capillary action as needed during drier weather. Capillary bunkers last longer, average a 3-year payback, and provide better, more consistent player experiences, all with a 10-year performance guarantee. For more information, visit capillarybunkers.com.
We're back to part two of our conversation with golf course Pacific Northwest golf course architect Dan Hixon. This is Brad Klein on behalf of TurfNet Renovation Report, thanking our sponsors for this conversation, the Andersons, Golf Preservations, and Capillary Bunkers. Maybe I shouldn't call you Pacific Northwest golf course architect. It's not like you're confined to that place. Maybe there'll be offers coming from elsewhere. Everybody has a breakthrough moment at some point. In your work, I assume that in many cases, I know this was the case with Ben, golf keep is, when you did the bunker plan there recently, golf is being played while you're working. I think Ben was 9 and 9, or they shut down 9 at a time to do the bunkers. But I assume, is there a different dynamic when you're doing it that way? Do you prefer to shut down the whole golf course, or does it just depend on the scope of work? You know, because
scope of work primarily, but you know, at Portland, we closed 3 holes at a time is all. And then as the project went along, and we were there from middle of July until the bad weather hit close to December 1st. And I'll tell you, Portland was interesting because they hadn't done anything even close to major to their golf course since the 60s. And it was a Robert Trent Jones Sr. deal. And so we were rebuilding bunkers, and they really had... It's a great golf course, but it really needed this renovation. And so the interacting with the membership walking by, they weren't necessarily playing those holes, but I got to know a lot of the members and would see them almost every day. And the looks on their faces once we got a few things in the ground was just amazing. And they were super supportive. And the thing has gone through with, you know, just as good a reviews as you could get from the membership. And so that was quite fun. You know, your first impression would be that you want the thing closed so you can concentrate and not have to worry about members, but you know, we kind of work around them, and that has a lot to do with the club professional as well as the superintendent communicating in today's world of, you know, what the golf course is going to be like when you come out. And so, you know, like I said, at Portland, Jason and then the golf pro staff, Tim Vall and Dave Lebeck, they were great as well, really just communicating daily. And, you know, every time they were out, they would introduce me to members, and then those members would come by every day and say, what are you going to do here? You know, because they just love to watch the transformation of the club.
Mm-hmm. Do you, when you're doing a plan like that, do you get involved in the run up to the implementation through member education, trying to help with a vote, that sort of thing? Or does that more left to the club itself?
No, I do quite a bit of that. You know, usually it's a long range plan that starts out, my rough draft is just a PowerPoint presentation to a committee board, you know, 15 or 20 people. And then oftentimes at Portland, gosh, we did 2 or 3 fireside chats. We did one that was supposed to be a walk around. We thought 30 or 40 people would show up, and it was like 210 people. And you know, so it's, you know, and those are pretty fun too. And, you know, fortunately I've been able to do those and keep people at bay and not get too much, outside stuff going on. And I even enjoy that part of it as well, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it's an important part of the stewardship and the ownership that members have in their club. It sometimes can get overdone. You know, I'm sure you get your suggestions about an island green and flash white sand and waterfalls as well.
Yeah, we've had a few of those. And, usually if it's a crazy idea, I'm fairly political in the sense I can usually talk them down from it and say, you know, that's just not the direction we're going. And one advantage of being a club pro that I just really enjoy, and I can say stuff to these clubs. I mean, if any one club leaves, it's not going to really affect me. I mean, I have enough work that if I tick somebody off at one club, so, I can kind of say things, and I'll tell the GM and the golf pro and the superintendent, I can say this to this guy because he's completely off par, but you can't. And usually it's, we all know that type of person that pushes something. And so everybody's usually happy when you kind of tell somebody off and say, hey, they hired me to do this. If you don't like this idea, maybe you need to talk to the board and the committee to get rid of me and to do your idea. And, they usually walk out of the room.
How often do you deal with the phenomenon of some of the work being contracted out to members? Does that work for you? Do you prefer to have it? And I'm not talking about major contract work, but sometimes subcontracting.
I haven't dealt with that much.
Paths, for example. Yeah.
I haven't dealt with that very much. However, just as we speak, I'm a bunker plan for a smaller club in the area. A member there is he works for a golf contracting company that's interested in doing this bunker renovation. And I haven't done work with them for that group. They've kind of shifted away from golf more to parks and ball fields and stuff, but they want to do this project. And so, mm-hmm. And I'm kind of asking the guy, are you sure you want to work at your own club? but I haven't faced that much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always a little complicated. I tell clubs mainly only hire people you can fire or sue. And if it's a member, it gets a little awkward. Any trends you're seeing in terms of design work? In the rest of the country, we're seeing big bunker plans, a lot of irrigation, weather or climate. Or big issues. What are you seeing in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, the major clubs really are going through about a 10-year irrigation renovation. Almost every major club is either done it, doing it, or about to do it. And that price escalation has really thrown everybody for a loop. I mean, essentially, they're twice the price that they were just 4 or 5 years ago. Right. And hard to get contractors and the details and the intricacies of it, it seems to be getting a little more difficult. And so irrigation for sure. Like I said, with COVID and everything and just the economy, there's just more money involved. And so clubs that never did work or suddenly have flush with money and looking to do projects. Often renovation just comes down to, and I'm not the first to say it, it's pretty clear deal. It's usually tree removal and grassing lines and bunker plans, and then, and on top of that, a fourth note would probably be tees, both shorter and back and, flatter and bigger and just the renovation of tees. And I think that kind of covers most of it.
My sense is that for years, golf courses, or at least committees, were trying to get their golf course longer. It might not have been the most sensible thing because they were in the process of ignoring how their golfers actually played. But it seems to me that every course now is putting in forward tees, family tees, way up there.
Yep.
Are you seeing that as well?
Oh, yeah. Gosh. Of all the master plans I have out there, many of them still have, and they're doing all the time, just what you said, those forward tees. And oftentimes they're out in the fairway where we just lift it a little bit of grade, come home with fairway units and I do that all the time. And it's really great too. And I love the clubs that kind of resist it, whether it's from the senior men or from the golfing women there that don't want to do it. And then once they get going on it, it's like, gosh, it takes them a little while to push them over. But once they go, they don't go back. And that's really fun.
Yeah. And are you seeing, are the clubs you're getting, I don't know if they're landlocked or not, are you seeing a move toward more diverse practice facilities and short courses, Himalaya putting greens, nine-hole courses, that's nine-hole par threes, that sort of thing?
Yeah. I've done quite a few of the putting courses and have a couple of people that are talking about them right now. You know, everybody's trying to find land to either expand their driving ranges or find short game areas. It's really a land issue. You know, most of the stuff I'm working on outside of my original projects are, you know, in the cities. And so they have pretty much landlocked situations, but it's practice is huge and driving range, you know, but they're obviously really important, but so many places just don't have room for expansion.
Right. Yeah. The older clubs in particular. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about your design influences? What do you, I don't know if you're the kind of person who tries to do template holes or, you know, the Redan Bieritz sort of thing, or do you, what do you draw upon for influences, I guess, or, you know,
I always used to tell people that kind of my favorite was Alistair McKenzie, you know, just, I really liked his courses on the West Coast here that I'd played. But really, I don't do anything much like him. Maybe mm-hmm. some flowing greens and stuff. But I don't, you know, my projects, oftentimes I go into a course that has 50 or 60 bunkers and we walk out with 30 or 40 and really try to be efficient in them. And he would write and talk about the efficiency, that everything needs a purpose and no wasteful ones. But he often put them, you know, behind greens that are, you know, you could never really hit them into, just to create a beautiful scene. And so, I don't know, I think, you know, back to that observation comment, you know, I think I'm lucky in the sense that I have never worked for anybody. And, you know, I got the influence of C. Bandon up close, right? When I was starting, it was just coming online, and really just see the quality that those, and the detail that those guys thought things through. And not that I copy any of them, I admire all their work and stuff, but, you know, I think a lot of the people that worked in the, you know, 80s and 90s building a whole bunch of golf courses, the way they did it just didn't suit me. I mean, I wanted to have, you know, handmade stuff or stuff built specifically for that golf course, that club at the time. And so I try to stay real flexible, because I do work at, you know, a former Ryder Cup. They want the highest absolute quality that they can get, right down to, you know, the Muni just that I'm working on now is we're trying to make something really fun and unique with some design details, but, you know, very simple bunkers and so on and so forth. So, you know, I'm kind of always changing design ideas, and having worked in so many clubs in such a small area too, that I like to keep it fresh. You know, I don't want one club, you know, 4 miles away, work on another club and say, well, he did the same thing right at our place. That happens a lot, and what did about, happen a lot.
Well, you're going, you mentioned McKenzie, whose greens, dramatic slopes on those. Of course, in those days in the 20s, if you had stimped them, they'd be running at about 4.5 on a stimp meter.
Yeah.
So what happens, how do you stand on that whole issue of slope versus speed for modern greens?
Well, it's funny, because we're working on, you know, right in my little town here of Lake Oswego, the Muni and the Country Club. The Country Club, they run it, you know, as fast as you can get, and it's on a big side slope of a golf course. And so we got to really be careful with, you get much over 3%, you can't put a pin on it if there's any steeper slopes below it. And so we work real hard at there. But then now at the Muni, I just had the superintendent at the Muni go to lots of the grass seed and bent grass seed gets grown here and researched here. And so I had them out at a lab just yesterday to pick the final deal. Cause I think we only want those greens to run at about an 8 on the stimp meter. So we can go up to 4.5% pinnable areas and stuff. Yeah. So I can kind of, in a way, almost more exciting greens. And, you know, one of my favorite courses is Indian Canyon. And I think you and I've talked about it before, and in Spokane, a Chandler Egan course, and it hasn't been altered hardly at all through the years. And those greens, they pin, you know, 5% and 6% sloped areas for tournaments and stuff. And they really work, and it's really fun to play where you have these big breakers that don't just continue to break off the green. And so, you know, so I mean, we all say it, but we're probably not going to go backwards and slow greens right. down.
Yeah.
So.
Now that's a municipal golf course, isn't it? Indian Canyon in Spokane.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. They played the U.S. Pub Links there in the 80s and, mm-hmm. and probably before that as well. So.
Yeah. Now you had done a master plan for them, or did it, are you in the process, or what's going on?
I have done no work towards the golf course, but back in the, in the early teens, I did a long range plan for actually the tribe that owns the casino near there. We're trying to fund a renovation for it, and they wanted to have naming rights. It was going to be something at Indian Canyon. And so the tribe had hired me and wanted me to do the work. So I did a kind of a fairly quick long range plan, you know, laying out what I would do, and mm-hmm. And everything was a go, but the city didn't take the proposal from the tribe. So I've never done any physical work to it, but I really know that course well, having played, you know, 10 years of basically 5 rounds for a tournament there through the years. And so it's just love the place. And so I use that all the time on Egan courses that I've worked on is the thoughts that he did there. Cause I know it's not altered much. So
if you had to kind of describe Egan's design approach, how would you do that?
I don't know. You know, his course has varied quite a bit. He's similar to A.V. McCann, and they kind of crossed over. He was from British Columbia, Northwest guy, worked on a million courses. And, you know, he does, Egan has, he sort of did his own templates. He did quite a few greens that tilted hard left to right, or even ran away from you, or right to left, just really at grade type greens. But then when he got into a hillier site like Indian Canyon or Oswego Lake, where I'm working, and even at Bend, he made some greens with quite a bit of movement to them. But my favorite ones are his ones that are really just the approach of the green is really at grade and, you know, tilted one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. And did he leave much of a design documentary record? You know, with Donald Ross, for example, Tillinghast, there's a fairly good, not complete, but fairly good body of archival material. Egan did not do that, did he?
No, I have photographs of his original plan for Indian Canyon. I know Waverly did a lot of research and found some great aerials from, I think, 1934 when they, cause they truly went backwards and did a historical restoration. Mm-hmm. Of his, and those I think were the best photos of it. And I don't think he wrote much about his stuff at all. And I know a writer, Tony Deer from the Northwest here, has always been interested in writing an Egan book, but I don't know. I worry that it would be 36 pages long is all, you know, and just our description of it as opposed to, you know, getting some insight to him.
Right. Yeah. Well, that is one of the issues. As good a set of courses as there are out in the Pacific Northwest and in the West generally, the detail plans, other than a George Thomas, for example, are fairly sparse. So,
yeah,
and you never know. I guess the hard part, of course, is that you never know if what you're looking at is some version of the original or how much of it was, you know, bulldozed over and renovated and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only one that has merited that is his work at Waverly. And I know they have not reservations, but they're not positive how much of that he did too. Right. You know, they're on their second site by the time he helped them with their first site, and then somebody else started the second site, and then he finished it. And so they try to give him full credit, but they're not even positive that he deserves full credit, if that's the right way to say it. But
yeah, and I know that was a similar issue at Bend as well. But that gives you quite a bit of license, in effect, to kind of create that legacy, both for him and for you. So,
yeah,
that's to your credit.
So maybe I framed it my own way, but I always just kind of say, you know, I think I've seen, you know, at Waverly, he certainly did grass down bunkers. And I know I thought I've read somewhere about Pebble Beach that a lot of the kind of the big waste bunkers with islands in them, I thought I read that he has laid those out. And even after, you know, the let's see, was it McKenzie that came back into Pebble Beach and redid it again?
Yeah.
I know he was part of when it upgraded once. And, you know, and then he did kind of flash sands at Indian Canyon and elsewhere. And, you know, even Oswego, Oswego Lake doesn't have very good photos of that really reveal anything. The aerials are kind of grainy and hard to see the details. And that course has changed around so many times with land sales and housing changes around it and stuff. So that's why Indian Canyon's so great, is it's, you know, it's probably 90 some percent what he laid out. And so,
well, I want to thank you for your time. Our guest today is golf course architect Dan Hixon for TurfNet Renovation Report. This is Brad Klein, and we're thankful to our sponsors for this conversation, the Andersons, Golf Preservations, and Capillary Bunkers. Dan, maybe next time we talk, we'll be hearing about a project that you're doing on the other side of the Rockies, or maybe even out here in the East. I think we would all benefit from that kind of cross-pollination, if you will. So,
well, thank you. Hopefully that's true.
It's always been a pleasure talking to you, and I cherish the time we spent together at Sylvie's Valley Ranch back in...
Yeah, that was fun.
A few years ago now, actually.
Yeah, probably in 18.
Yeah, I'd have to look it up. It was one of those, yeah, pre-COVID.
When you got covered with cow pie.
I went out with the owner, and we went for a ride in, what was it, the Razor. And it was, we were out there for a little while, and I realized there was no side truck to the, no side doors to the vehicle, and we were going through fields occupied by grazing animals who were expelling twice as much as they were taking in. And I got most of it on the right side of my leg. I cherish that memory.
I remember that. That's a great story. I love it.
Yeah.
Who cares about the golf course I built, reversible and all that, but you got to experience a cow pie on the leg.
That was my lead. I can't remember exactly. I think I said something about the stuff was flying as I was out there. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.